You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Bridget Bergen, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. Child welfare agencies across the country are notoriously underfunded, understaffed, and overburdened. And the pandemic has only made things worse, with workers leaving their jobs in droves. In Kentucky, Governor Andy Beshear raised salaries by 10% in order to try to retain workers when some 600 left the system last year, many for higher-paying, lower-stress jobs.
These folks can work for Target and Chick-fil-A and McDonald's for double what the state pays them. When they have to have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, go in people's homes, had a gun put to their head, take away kids who are burned from a family who's so desperate that that's what how they're acting out.
That was Marta Miranda Straub, Commissioner of Kentucky's Department of Community-Based Services, speaking with WLKY. Some states have adopted algorithmic screening tools to help identify cases that are likely to be the highest risk, using data to try to help prioritize cases for workers and systems that are stretched to the breaking point. Agencies in at least 26 states, plus D.C., have considered using algorithms, and at least 11 states are currently using them. Developers say such tools can help welfare officials with large caseloads save children from neglect and even combat racism and bias in human decision-making. But many say it's doing exactly the opposite. Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, adopted a tool that was designed to predict the risk a child would be placed in foster care in the 2 years after they were investigated. It used historic data to calculate a child's potential risk of abuse or neglect and assigned that child a score from 1 to 20. The higher the score, the higher the risk. But research from a team at Carnegie Mellon, first reported by the AP earlier this year, found that these algorithmic decisions are simply reinforcing the structural inequities they were adopted to address. The tool in Allegheny County was actually flagging 2/3 of Black children for investigation, as opposed to just 1/2 of all other children. And the county's social workers themselves disagreed with the algorithm's scores at least 1/3 of the time. Joining us is Anjana Samanth, senior attorney for the ACLU Women's Rights Project. She previously served as assistant attorney general in the Civil Rights Bureau of the New York State Attorney General's Office. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How does bias end up showing up in these systems?
Well, in the simplest sense, what these tools are doing, the screening tools, is generating a risk score for complaints that are received. And the way the tool is created is that the tool designers looked at an agency's historical cases and then looked to identify the characteristics that keep coming up again and again in those past cases. Identify then among those characteristics which ones are associated with different outcomes and which characteristics may show up more often than others. And then basically try to predict what the odds of some future event is based on how often those characteristics are now coming in or appearing in complaints. I think one of the things to really keep in mind is that even though they're called risk assessment tools or risk prediction tools, one question to ask is risk of what? Because no one can predict the future. No math equation or computer program can actually tell us when violence or death is going to happen. So while the tools are described as predicting the risk of harm to children or risk of maltreatment, what they're really measuring is the relative odds of something happening that is being used as a proxy for harm. And in the case of a lot of the call screening tools, the proxy, the something that the tool is predicting, is actually the odds that a child is in the complaint is going to be removed from their parents by the agency within 2 years. And here's where one of the problems lies. Removing a child from the home is not a clear or even necessarily likely indicator that the child has been abused. So according to the most recent federal compilation of data, 61% of all cases in which agencies substantiated maltreatment allegations involved only neglect. And while the definition of neglect varies from one place to the next, at minimum, it's basically something along the lines of an act or failure to act that creates an imminent risk of serious harm.
There's so much to unpack here. So just kind of slow us down a bit. It sounds like when you think about the types of data that are being gathered, that this algorithm is likely to target a pretty specific group of people. Is that fair?
So the tools are created using publicly data that the government has in its possession. So they will pull on to find what characteristics have kept recurring in agencies' historical files. They'll look not only at the child welfare agency's demographic or breakdowns of those files, but they'll also then cross-reference that with the county or state's criminal justice data, so juvenile probation, jail records. They may also cross-reference it with behavioral health system data. So people who are using public services, SNAP, some places have looked at use of public benefits. But so people who are basically coming into contact with the state for reliance on the social network are ones whose data the government is going to have more readily at their fingertips. And these are people who are disproportionately poor, experiencing poverty, experiencing housing instability, and certainly are predominantly disproportionately Black, depending on what parts of the country you are in, also either Latinx or Native American.
And so when the algorithm determines a child's case to be high risk, what happens next? What does the agency do?
So when a higher end risk score comes up, the call screen worker then takes that number into account, at least this is how it's supposed to be used, to decide whether or not the complaint should be referred into the agency for some kind of investigation or safety check, or if they should just close out the complaint. So it's not replacing human decision making. Although, you know, in some places where these scores are used, if you fall on, let's say, the highest end of the score spectrum, then you're supposed to automatically get screened in for some kind of response. And in order to override that mandatory screen-in, a supervisor has to give some kind of explanation.
And so as agencies are using these tools, they say these algorithms aren't about making decisions. They're, as you said, they're simply tools to provide overworked caseworkers with guidance. And they say they're being trained to recognize these biases. What do you say to that?
So, you know, one of the problems with the tools for everyone, whether it's caseworkers or the general public, is just the lack of information we have about what actually is the tool measuring, what factors is it taking into account? Are there any factors that it's prohibited from using in trying to predict the odds that a child is going to be removed? So there's really no way to kind of insulate for that bias entirely, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the real concern is because this tool is going through historical records, and we know for a fact that both within the child welfare system, statistically, Black families, Native American families in particular, are disproportionately overrepresented and have been than white counterparts, for instance. These files are, and these statistics, these risk scores are baking in that disproportionality. They're assuming that that baseline of skewed participation is neutral or natural.
So how did these tools get put into place? Like, what was Allegheny County trying to fix here?
So I'd say, as you started out at the top, one of the issues that I think a lot of the jurisdictions that have adopted these tools are talking about is we want to do a better job of sifting through the complaints that come in to find the quote-unquote real real cries for help or the real abuse, as opposed to situations where agency intervention may not be required. I think the problem with that is, again, the risk that's being measured by the tool is not one of harm to the child, but it's actually, what are the odds that this kid is going to fit the profile of the type of situation where we, the agency, would have intervened in the past? So it becomes this cycle, right? It's not necessarily because it's not necessarily that these state interventions happen every time a child has been abused or harmed. Rather, again, children are often removed because of things like a child doesn't have a safe place to stay. Maybe they're living in a shelter. Maybe they don't have access to regular meals, or the ability to, their family isn't able to get to do laundry every day. And then they get flagged for not being able to provide and meet the basic needs of their child. So again, what the tool is measuring is how closely does a complaint match situations in which the agency has intervened in the past.
So the recent reporting on these systems has prompted some agencies to reconsider their use. Oregon announced at the beginning of June that it will stop using its algorithm system, but Allegheny County is so far not stopping its use and has even implemented a new surveillance program recently. Why do you think we're seeing these different responses?
I think it's a variety of factors. One, definitely, in some places is stakeholder opposition, right? So where people and communities, particularly communities who are impacted by it, are informed and are voicing opposition, that's one reason to certainly reassess whether you want to be using this tool to begin with. If the families that are directly impacted are telling you, look, refining whether or not I get called in isn't the problem, right? Maybe actually the interventions aren't useful. I think another reason is Illinois, for instance, used to use a risk assessment tool about that they ended up dropping about 5 years ago. And in public statements, they stated that we felt that the tool was no better at predicting harm than our caseworkers. So that was part of the reason that they dropped the tool. It's also can be expensive to use these tools properly, right? This isn't a one and done, installed some software, and then you can move on. These tools are, they are, quote, right, machine learning tools. So if you want to keep them up to date on what do, you know, the current case files look like, you do have to constantly be looking at your new, your more recent case files and feeding that information to tool designers or into the tool so that I can kind of see if the constellation of factors it flagged before continues to be the constellation of factors today. And that's where, that's where you end up with something that people have called a feedback loop. And that's the concern. You're going to keep feeding it this closed universe of information with the same demographics, the same kind of criteria, and that's just going to compound itself.
We're going to have to leave it there. Anjana Samant is senior attorney for the ACLU Women's Rights Project. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We reached out to Allegheny County's Department of Human Services for comment. A statement they provided said, in part, the algorithm was, quote, designed not to replace the worker, but rather to provide additional data that supplements other data they receive to help them screen referrals. We stand by our efforts to be transparent and accountable. We will continue to seek disconfirming views and criticism as opportunities to improve outcomes for vulnerable children and their families. Joining us now to explore this further is Nicolee Biddle, a licensed clinical social worker and child welfare reform advocate and lived experience expert based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Nicolee currently works for the Center for Study of Social Policy as a senior program analyst on their systems change team. Welcome to The Takeaway, Nicolee.
Hello, Bridget. Thanks for having me.
So prior to your work at the Center for the Study of Social Policy, you worked in family services. Can you tell us how families were identified as at risk prior to the implementation of any kind of algorithms?
Sure. So I worked in various child welfare private agencies in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And basically, those are the agencies that provide the foster care and adoption services for Allegheny County. And how families would be identified would be pretty typical. So most times a hotline report would be sent or made via phone or online about concerns about a child and family. And then the county receives that report and then they, you know, decide on their own to do an investigation or not, based on whatever the allegation was.
And what happens to children and their families once they're flagged for an investigation?
Well, in Pennsylvania, it depends on what the allegation is and whether they get tracked into like a general protective services or a child protective services based on that report. So child protective services would be, you know, very, very severe neglect or allegations of child abuse. And then the general protective services is a track that's more focused on, you know, allegations of neglect, truancy, stuff like that, from my understanding.
We're talking about these algorithms this morning. Can you talk us through the pros and or cons of using these algorithms to support social workers in the field?
Sure. I mean, the pros are that, from what I've been told, is that they can save a lot of time for workers and that they can also provide the workers with additional information in order for them to make a more informed decision. And so that's really the argument that Allegheny County uses for using the algorithm that they do, is that it provides their intake workers or the workers who are sifting through those hotline calls more mm-hmm. information in order to make a better decision on whether or not that child line report needs investigated. So cons with that would be that it feels very minority reportish, right? and what I mean by that is that in Allegheny County, they have a really unique and I think good system in that everything is under this one umbrella of the Department of Human Services. So that means it includes things like child protective services, behavior health, their childcare programs, like all of these things are under one umbrella agency, which helps to keep things more connected. But the caveat whenever using something like this is that this algorithm is able to pull all of this data from all of these different DHS systems. Mm-hmm. And with that, they're using those to make some type of determination about whether involvement in those various systems and services means that child is more likely to experience child abuse or neglect and come in contact with the child welfare system throughout their lifetime. And that's really where the problems come in, because that's where there's a lot of secrecy. And that's where there are a lot of judgments and biases, because although it's an algorithm evaluating this information, these are algorithms designed by real people. And these are also algorithms pulling from data that's sourced from systems that are not without bias. So it gets very sketchy and very the consequences can be really dire for families who fall victim to being investigated.
We know that this is certainly an imperfect system. You experienced the foster care system as a teenager. Can you tell us about your own experience?
So I did experience foster care as a teenager. I was in the system for about 7 years before aging out. And, you know, this was years ago at this point. And so this was before the algorithm or anything like that. But the thing that concerns me, especially now as a person who I've been able to acquire a lot of privilege, I have a good education and a good job and all, you know, a house and a car and all those good things that we don't necessarily see for a lot of former foster youth. So what I'm concerned of is that there's data in that DHS warehouse on me, right? And on my time of being in foster care and the services that I had to use as I transitioned out of care. And so let's say that there's a child line report made against me that, you know, I don't know, my child showed up to school dirty or something, you know, I'm using a really simplistic example here. But let's say that that happened and that the call hotline worker, that they receive this algorithm score that says, oh, this person has a higher score because they were in foster care or because they were, you know, on Medicaid when they were 23 or just whatever it says in there. We don't know what the impact that is on the score. So for me as a former foster youth, is the system rating that I'm at a higher risk of being, you know, of having my child in the system because of that?
It sounds like families aren't even aware that their data is being collected. Is that right?
I think in a broad sense, yes. I think that generally speaking, people know that, you know, they fill out forms and they have to jump through a lot of hoops to get some of these other services. But I think what they don't realize is how that data is then being used. And in some ways, it might be being used, you know, biased against them.
Do you think families will be less likely to seek support if they know that this information might be used against them in the future?
Oh, absolutely. We encourage people to use the services that are there. But the reality is that in cases like these, where we're not sure if that access to that service is going to count against them because they are a lower income family, for example, and that means that they're going to be more likely to be involved in child welfare in Allegheny County's eyes or any other system's eyes, that's really problematic. People think that it is really hard to have your children removed from you. And in a lot of cases, that's simply not true.
What are some of the structural and systemic issues that could drive these child services departments to seek out and use these kinds of automated tracking systems?
So the child welfare systems really across the board tend to be underfunded. They tend to be understaffed in that even if they have a full amount of staff, that staff keeps turning over. You know, they're really trying to make fewer resources stretch. And they're trying to look for some way to save some type of time and some type of stress on their workers. And they're also looking for a way, child welfare, historically, again, across the board is, a lot of times they're lacking that true data analysis and data that can really help inform decisions. So, you know, trying to build data and trying to make sure you're collecting a lot of data so that you can improve the system is not a bad thing, but more data in and of itself is also not inherently a good thing, depending on how that data is being used. So they're using these things to try to save some time so that they can hopefully make their resources stretch a bit further.
Nicolee Biddle is the Senior Program Analyst at the Center for the Study of Social Policy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.